Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for women over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. You're listening to WESU Middletown. I just want to welcome our listeners today. I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of For Women Over 40. I'm so glad you could join us. Today I'll be talking to writers and adventurers Jonna Kaplan and Jan Mann about traveling Connecticut, the ins and outs, where the best spots are, and more unique tips and tricks. Jonna Kaplan studied to be an actress in New York and somehow ended up a freelance writer and editor in Connecticut instead. Oh, that's sad. That is sad. She blogs about quirky, off-the-beaten-path local destinations at thesizeofconnecticut.com. She also writes about travel, history, lifestyle, Jewish issues, and has been published in such places as The Forward, Patch, Newsweek, About.com, and the Christian Science Monitor. Author, adventurer, speaker Jan Mann developed a passion for day tripping while on a spring wildflower hunt several years ago, visiting 20 parks, preserves, and nature centers in 6 weeks. After that, she kept going, scouring the state for interesting destinations for leisure time activities. The result was a day tripping, picnicking, and recipe book, first published in 2006, with second and third editions published in 2008 and 2012. Jan's love of adventure recently took her out of her home state on a 5-week, 6,400-mile road trip to the West with only her teddy bear and a canister of pepper spray for company. Is that true?
It is true.
Okay. Her second book, How I Won the West, A Journey of Discovery, was published in December 2014. Welcome, Jonna and Jan.
Thank you.
So exciting to have you. So I was thinking in preparation for the show that I've lived in Connecticut my whole life. And the truth of the matter is I do the best I can to besmirch my state because I'm always believing that the grass is greener elsewhere. And yet the two of you have found joy and delight in traveling the state. So tell me a little bit about how you came to write about travel in Connecticut and what is the allure for you, Jan?
Well, again, as you said earlier, I just started day tripping. It was a passion, and I just did it in my off time and loved traveling around the state looking for new leisure time activities. And I just kept going and going until I just had about explored the entire state. And then that's how I decided to write my day tripping book. I'd been referring to a lot of other day tripping books as I was seeking out new opportunities and researching. I've written all of my life. I still have my first rejection letter when I was 10 years old and sent a poem into the Hartford Times newspaper. And a week later, received this lovely rejection letter. But anyway, I just have always loved to write. And I said, well, what am I doing just traveling around? Why don't I write my own day tripping book instead of referring to other people's?
That's just really, really cool. Do you use the rejection letter as the fire and fuel for showing them?
I never thought of it like that, Emma. I never did. Because it was so long ago. I was only 10.
Yeah.
Now, I have to tell you, when this day tripping book was first published in 2006, it had been almost exactly 60 years since I received that first rejection.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So, Jonna, I'm first going to ask you, are you sorry at all that you left New York?
No, I'm not. I mean, I love New York. I was born there. It's one of my favorite places in the world. But I actually left because I realized I couldn't live there and travel at the same time because it's just too expensive. So leaving actually enabled me to travel, which got me into writing. And
so tell me a little bit for you about the allure of Connecticut. I mean, obviously you live here, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you would be captivated by where you live.
Right. Well, I grew up in Westport, which, if anyone is listening from elsewhere, is basically a suburb of New York City. I got out as soon as I possibly could, and I lived out of state for over 10 years. And it was only when I moved back in my late 20s that it even occurred to me to travel in Connecticut. I moved back to New London, which was so different that I might as well have moved back to a different state. I was discovering new things and new places every day. And I had already been writing professionally for a couple of years at that point, but I wanted to write about Connecticut because there was just so much here that I never knew growing up here.
You know, I think that's an interesting point before we really get started, that so much of the state has differing, very differing flair. That if you go in the northwest corner and you go to the Berkshires, it's so diametrically different from, say, Mystic. And I wonder, before we get going, do you think that's true of every state? Or do you think we have as much or more to offer in those ways?
I think it's unique in the sense that other states have diverse environments, but ours are so close together. And they're also, I think, all equally high caliber. So you might have some states that are great for beaches, but their inland is not quite as nice. I think everything we have is equally good.
Jen?
Yeah, I have to agree. And I think it's because of the small state that we live in that makes all of our attractions or versatile attractions more noticeable. I mean, we have everything. We have the mountains, and we have the valleys, and the seashore, and the rivers, and the lakes. And there probably isn't anything that any other state doesn't, any other state has that we don't. Maybe in a smaller capacity, but yeah, we're very versatile, and I think that's one of the attractions of Connecticut.
So let me just make sure I understand. Do both of you have ulterior motive to help me like my state by the end of this hour?
I can definitely do that.
Okay.
I have been known to start plugging Connecticut in the opportunity.
Okay.
So sounds like a good plan.
Yeah, I think I might. So, Jen, tell me a little bit about what you decided to write about and what you think your specialty is.
In my book, what I did is I looked for versatility and just what we were talking about in our state. And so I have 42 day trips. And I have 11 different categories. For instance, city walking tours, fall fun and foliage, hiking and biking, historic homes and gardens, water fun, wineries, and on and on. So my 42-day trips are all listed under one of the categories because in my book, I want to take my readers with me on the day trip, but I also want them to know how many activities they can take part in. And then because I wanted my day tripping book to be set apart from all the others on the market, I decided to add the picnicking areas. So from then on, I only researched places that have picnicking, which almost every place does, whether you're sitting on the ground, a park bench, or an actual picnic table.
I have a theory that picnicking is in its decline because our forays to the state parks produce less and less picnic areas or, you know, how the wooden tables are usually set up. I find less and less.
You know, that's so true. But picnicking has been on a decline for many years, I think. And I've tried to revive it in many ways during all my talks about my day tripping book in Connecticut and blogs and every other chance I get, trying to get people to realize how exciting it is to go on a picnic. Especially when you're outdoors in the middle of nature or you're doing an activity and then you sit back and enjoy this wonderful picnic. Yes, it is on the decline, and I don't really know why it hasn't come back. It should.
So, Jonna, tell me a little bit about the sort of off-the-beaten-path locales that you look for. How do you do the research for that, and is that your specialty?
Yeah, I very much gravitate towards places that are not major tourist destinations, or if they are, I'll approach them from a slightly different angle. I think I mostly start with history, really. I just gravitate towards the history of a place, whether it's a place known for its history or whether it's not, that's what I will look for. And that kind of just leads me just through being aware. Sometimes I just look at maps and think, where have I not been and what could be there? You know, that will lead me to the places I don't have to look very hard, especially around here.
So take me through, you know, what would be a typical ritual that you would go through in trying to explore someplace new? So you would think of what and then look at a map?
Yeah, I would think of where have I not been? And then I would look it up and think about, you know, any place in Connecticut that you look up, there's going to be someone who has written about its history. People are very interested here in the past of their own small town. So there's going to be something there, and then I'll go, and hopefully there will be good pictures, too, because photography is a big part of my blog and a hobby of mine.
Could you safely say that nearly any place that you would visit, you could find some measure of interest, both for yourself and the reader or the potential traveler?
Definitely.
That's interesting. So in terms of travel philosophies, Jean, would it be safe to say that probably you have been looking more at what a tourist might be also looking for, as opposed to, you know, the phrase was brought up, thinking like a local? Maybe you could explain to me what your travel philosophy is and who are you hoping to attract?
Well, that's an interesting question, Sima, because I want to be attracted to the place first. Before I can offer it to my readers, I need to be excited about it and passionate about it. So that's the first step for me, is to look at an area that excites me and promises me something new, some exciting adventure. And then, of course, if I'm writing about it, then I write from the point of view of the reader. I try to share with them what led me to this place and what excited me about it. You know, as far as travel destinations or philosophies, like a local, I think that, as Jana said, we can find exciting areas in every single town in Connecticut. I don't know how many towns do we have. I think 169. Thank you. And I've been to most of them, if not all, in my research for this book. And, you know, when I give talk, it invariably somebody in the audience will ask me every time, and then it will get a discussion going, and everybody wants me to visit their town. As Jana said, everybody's, you know, connected to their own place, and they know exciting places that I've never heard of. You know, it's interesting. Years ago, someone said to me, gosh, you know so much about Connecticut. You probably know the entire state. And I laughed. I said, not by a long shot. I haven't even scratched the surface. So, I think that locals have a pride in their place, and I think it's well-deserved.
You know, you're reminding me of the books that I read going to college, and, you know, they're failing me, but kind of like an Ernest Hemingway, you know, all the books that were written about traveling the country and exploring all the areas that you had never heard of. I mean, you're mm-hmm. reminding me about that kind of wanderlust feeling. And I am mm-hmm. actually, I'm sharing it with the two of you because I can feel your passion, and that in turn is actually sort of igniting it in me, you know, thinking twice about maybe I should be out there too, you know, which I'm hoping is what you mean to be offering our listeners today.
Absolutely. It's interesting you should use the word wanderlust, because that's the word I use in my first chapter of my book, my book Out West, How I Won the West. I've been a wanderlust for my whole life, and I guess I never thought of it in terms of day tripping, but yeah, that's exactly what it is.
So before we move on, I just wanted to ask you, are there any places for each of you that have truly resonated with you, that for some reason, when you sat there or looked there or drove there, you either had the feeling that you'd been there before, or that it just really touched you in a way that you returned back? And it could even be, you know, a rock on the beach, or, you know, I don't even mean a specific town. Have you had experiences like that?
In Connecticut, for me, that would be the Southeast. I moved to New London kind of at random when I decided to come back to this area. Stonington Borough especially is absolutely, that's the place here that I'll always return to. That's pretty much a perfect Connecticut town, in my opinion. And I have places like that across the country, too. I mean, sometimes you do just find a place, and it's meaningful to you, and maybe you don't even know why.
Jim?
Yeah, interesting, Jana. How we get connected to places. You know, there's just something that goes through us about a place, and we often don't know what that is. You know, I spent over 20 years visiting the the destinations in my book. I won't even go into why, just life happened, and so I was 20 years or more, actually, in the writing of this book, which meant that I visited all my destinations multiple times, dozens, through the years to keep up with it. Every time I took the manuscript out, I'd have to revisit the places all over again. And I guess I tell you this because I'm attached, so attached to all of the places. Every time I go, I just marvel anew at the attractions that brought me to this place and the attractions for the visitors. And so I don't really have, at this point, any one place that I can say is my favorite. When I go back to my trips now that my book is out, when I go back to the destinations, it usually has something to do with the time of year. For instance, you know, in the summer, the shoreline beckons me to the ocean and to Branford for the Thimble Islands cruise. In the fall, I'm driven to Litchfield County for the foliage, you know, Kent Falls and Cornwall-covered bridge. In the spring, it's hiking Talcott Mountain State Park. So, again, I think I would have to answer you that it's the weather that draws me back to places.
How about you, Jenna?
Now, my favorite place, I would have to say, is a new place. I have places that I like to return to, but the place that I always want to go is the place I haven't been.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Mm-hmm.
So what would you tell people about Connecticut? For people who don't know much about the state and they don't know where to go in the state and they don't know what to do if they were to choose this state as opposed to another state and say New England, how would you help guide them?
I think it depends what they're looking for because, as we were saying earlier, you really can find everything. But I would tell them that it's not the way that it's portrayed, you know, as a Connecticut punchline, as just a rich, waspy state. There's a lot more to it than that. As far as specific places, I would say my two kind of underrated places that people should go is the Quiet Corner, which is up in the northeast corner, and the shoreline from about Brantford to Stonington. Those two areas are really laid back, unpretentious, old-fashioned New England landscapes. Those two places, you can really literally get lost and you are guaranteed to find something amazing all by yourself.
Tell me something about what you would find. So take me on a day trip and you're down there and you're wandering around.
Mm-hmm.
Where would your eyes stop, or where would your car stop?
Oh, I break for little old buildings. Like I have a lot of one-room schoolhouses on my blog, and I actually started an Instagram account just for Connecticut one-room schoolhouses. I stop for those, any old building. I love old barns, beaches, obviously, and I like them better in the off-season when they're not crowded. They're free. No one else thinks to go to New England beaches in the winter except New Englanders, which I think is a mistake because they're kind of at their best and most dramatic then. Country roads, just old houses I love. There's so much architecture. I could go on and on.
No, I'd like you to, because actually it's taking me back to before I had children and when I myself would get in my car and I'd go to Salem, Mass, and I'd pretend that I lived there a few hundred years ago, or I would go to Old Wethersfield. And no, keep talking, please, because I think you are taking the listener on a ride, and that's part of what I wanted to do today.
Okay, well, I'm a city person, I think, really, at heart. I was born in New York, and I'm just a city girl. So I think that's why I really like exploring countryside places and small towns, because to me they're always a little bit exotic. It sounds funny to say, but it's just you encounter things that you don't see in your normal environment if you are a city person. And I would also say for the reverse, if you live in a small town, Connecticut cities have a lot of really unexpected things you can find because our cities don't have great reputations, and I think that keeps a lot of people out.
So give me a few. I'm sorry. Hmm? Give me a few examples of cities you think are overlooked.
I live in Hartford currently, so I will say Hartford has, in addition to really first-rate museums and live theater history. Hartford has great parks. I don't think that people think about going to Hartford and being in a rose garden, but you have that in Elizabeth Park, or really strolling in the shadow of the state capitol, in perfectly manicured green lawns and fountains, but you have that in Bushnell Park. So I think Hartford is overrated, it's underrated, sorry, in general.
Jim?
Well, I have to agree with a lot of what Jana said, and especially the city. I grew up in Hartford. And when I was writing my book, I had all the, you know, rest of the state, and I said, well, wait a minute, why don't I do a category called City Walking Tours? So, of course, Hartford was an obvious choice for me, and I bring my readers to many of the areas that Jana mentioned. And then I said to myself, okay, I can't have a category with one city, so I need to pick another city. And so I picked New Haven, and I had had very little interaction with New Haven. I had driven there less than a handful of times, but usually for something specific during the years. And so this time I took myself to New Haven, and it was so much easier than I thought it would be. I of course, had a map. I got off at the exit, and I found an area of parking around the green, the town green, which I explored, the three major churches there, and then took a walk to the museums. And I thought, wow, this is so easy. I loved it. And so that was my second city walking tour. But I think, as Jana said, the city is underestimated. And I think people have, unfortunately, a little bit of a fear of going into a city. And that's too bad. And I can understand that if they've never been in a city or spent any time in a city. Again, I grew up in Hartford, and it was easy for me. And even though New Haven was a little bit of a little bit of a tense thing, I found it, again, so simple. And I hope more people will consider going to the city where they can find wonderful museums. Even small towns like New Britain has one of my very favorite museums, and it isn't in my book, but I go there often, the New Britain Art Museum. You know, I just couldn't fit it in. I mean, they have outdoor picnicking and everything there. I think there's a lot of things overlooked in Connecticut because people tell me they don't have time.
Well,
to just explore. But I say you can make the time.
I also think that, and either of you can stop me, I think that if you live in a small town, you tend to have a better grasp of that town's attractions, maybe a little bit more about the history. I think that for a lot of people living in the major cities in Connecticut, they walk right by revered institutions, venerable architecture, probably for most of their lives and never even see it for what it is. Do you agree?
I think people do have a lot of pride. I'm sure a lot of people do what you said as well, or walk by, the Wadsworth and don't go in because they went when they were little on a school field trip or what have you. But I think really in Connecticut, the thing is that people know their own little area, but they don't think about the rest of the state. I've gotten so many emails since I started the blog of people who grew up in one town or they just moved to a town and they had no idea that an hour or two away there were all these other things to do in the same state.
So,
our most well-known tourist attraction in Connecticut has to be Mystic.
Mm-hmm.
I it's hard to believe how many people I've talked to who have lived in our state for like 14, in one case, 17 years in another, and have never driven to Mystic.
I think that's true.
Really surprises me.
Yeah,
you know,
I think that's very
just
true.
Just so much to offer. Mystic Aquarium, Mystic Village, Mystic Seaport, downtown Mystic, suitable for children, adults, and everybody in between.
I just wrote a blog post saying exactly what you're saying about Mystic. I did grow up going there. We went with school groups all the time. We were, it seems like every year we were at the Seaport, but I never knew that Mystic had a downtown until until I moved back to Connecticut, you know?
Oh, one of my favorite parts of Mystic downtown, walking over the antique Bascule Bridge, and how about the Drawbridge ice cream shop? I hope you went in there for the best ice cream in the state. Oh, yeah, I love downtown. Little shops, yeah.
You know, you bring up an interesting point about downtowns. So you have a town like West Hartford, which not only made the Kiplinger's top 10 list, but really its major attraction is its downtown. And I wondered if you both could address the nature of downtown in Connecticut. You know, you would have something like Collinsville, which is almost like northern exposure. That's how I explain it to people from out of state. And then you have something like West Hartford Center, which is very much like Newton, Mass. Or Bethesda, Maryland. And so tell me a little bit about the nature of downtown and how that may or may not appeal to tourists.
I love downtowns, whether it's a small town center or a bigger one, because they all grew up authentically out of, you know, the initial settlement and just a few little necessary buildings, town greens, which are often right by the downtown. And I think Connecticut is, people think of it as really a car state because you do have to drive and our public transportation doesn't go everywhere. But once you get to a town, no matter how small, there usually is a little walkable town center.
I want to go back to your methodologies because I think I want to get into both of your minds. I want to really understand how you would, you know, we started talking about how you might wake up in the morning and decide that you were in the mood for traveling somewhere. But I really would like to understand the complexity behind that and then your ultimate desire to share that with the public because both of you obviously are writers. So if you could start, Jan, and just tell me, what would a morning look like if you wake up and you say, I'm in the mood to travel, and today I would like to go, and then kind of take me through your steps.
I'm an organized person, and when I'm going to an area for the first time, I like to research. It's not that I don't love to get in my car and just drive, and I do that as well. But I'm always afraid I'm going to miss something. You know, it's just like we're talking about. You drive through a town, you might not know that there's a historic building around the next corner. So I'm into research. So my typical day would be get up and say, okay, I feel like taking a day trip. I've got to have some resource material in front of me, either online or books or maps or something, other publications that are going to at least get me started, at least put me on the right path in the right direction. And then when I get to that destination, then I will have a place to start. And from there, I'm usually starting with the touristy destinations, the things that I've read about, the things that sound interesting to me. But once I'm there, and every time I go back, I'm more apt to just fly, if you will, on my own and be more adventuresome and look around corners and drive down odd streets and walk, you know, around the corner and see what's there. So that's my method.
And when you do this, do you usually take a full day? I mean, is this a picnicking day? Is this a day where you try to eat in the local eateries?
For me, I picnic as often as I can.
Okay.
I love picnics. I think there's a certain romance to going on a picnic, especially if you have a real picnic basket. And so I picnic as often as I can, but there are times when I cannot or I don't have enough time. And you ask whether it's a day or not, and many times it is, but many times I don't have a day. So I'll be content with going to a place that's a little bit closer and just doing a half-day trip. And in that case, depending on the hours that I'm out, I may look for a local restaurant. So every trip is different, Sima. Every trip is different for me.
And do you take notes?
Oh, yes, always. Yes, I always have a journal pad with me because there's no question that I'm going to see things. Not only do I want to record in my notebook, but I also want to perhaps pass this information along, either to friends or relatives, or even if I'm not writing about it for the public. Yes, I always take many notes.
And when you get there, do you make a point of trying to talk to as many locals as possible, or do you ever speak with anyone?
You know, that's a very good point, because it definitely is more beneficial to us to talk to locals. And locals are much more apt to speak to us if we make the first move. In other words, it's hard for some of us to go up to someone just standing there and start talking. How are they going to react? Are they going to walk away? Are they going to trust us? More cases than not, they will be very friendly and open, and they will be honored to tell us about their town. So we need to do more of that. And it isn't easy for me, but I try whenever I can, and I'm always, always rewarded.
That's wonderful. So, Jonna, let's start again. So you wake up in the morning and you decide this is a travel day. Mm-hmm. Take me through your ritual.
Well, it's very much like what Jan said. I do a lot of research. I will probably have been doing the research for days or weeks beforehand. I mean, not steadily, but I will have been taking notes, looking things up beforehand so that that day I can just get up and go. The only difference to what Jan said earlier is that I probably wouldn't start with a touristy destination. I probably would start with getting angry that some place gets all the attention and thinking, but this other place should get more attention because it's just as good, you know. So I'll start with that and I'll find out what is there, then I'll go. And then once I'm there and I've done the research, then I'll always find something that I had no idea was there that I want to explore, and then I'll explore that.
So what would be some of the places that you think are most maligned or most ignored? What are some of the towns or destinations?
Oh, gosh. Well, I guess I would say the eastern half of the state, which sounds a little funny to say because the bulk of the tourism revenue that we take in comes in through Mystic and the two casinos. But outside of those destinations, which are right on the highway, so you can come in, get off, do those things, get on the highway, go back out again, I think, and I've said this before, but the eastern kind of whole part of the state is not very, it's not as populated, so it's not as well-known. But, you know, just there are other towns, too. There are pretty much everywhere that is not one of those major destinations, or even within a town, you know, if there's one.
So do you mean towns like Putnam? Mentioned Stonington.
I actually lived in Putnam for a year, and Putnam, I think it still has its old reputation of being really run down, and now, of course, it's all restaurants and antique stores.
Absolutely.
That's a great little town.
Absolutely. So once you've done your visiting and you're back at home, do you immediately start writing? And if so, is there an intent with your writing, or are you hoping to inform, educate, or just entertain?
If it's for my blog, I will start by editing my photos because I do take a lot of notes, but I primarily remember blogging things that I've seen through photos. If it's for another assignment, I'll just start writing. But I go off of the notes that I've taken before I travel someplace, and then I take, usually when I never come home at a loss for what I want to say about a place. I really have been sort of thinking about it in my head for the whole time I've been there, and I usually have a pretty good idea of what I want to share. And it is that. It is education. That's maybe kind of a serious word for the type of writing I do on the blog, but it's usually just I want to get the word out there because I want to share these places that are not very well known.
So in terms of your writing, did either of you kind of study from the masters or read any other travel writers, either before you began your foray into writing about travel or while you now still write about travel? Are there people you follow whose methodologies you admire or whose writing skills help you create better works?
I always read travel writing before I had any idea that I would want to do it myself. There was always something about it that I love. And I have a lot, I try not to copy people, obviously, but yeah, I have a lot of favorite writers.
Can you name any?
Sure, Rebecca West, who wrote Black Lamb and Grace Halkin, which people will probably know. Robert Byron, The Road to Oxiana, that's also pre-World War II. I love Ian Fraser. He writes for The New Yorker now, but his travel books about America are excellent. I love Tony Horowitz, William Lee Heat Moon, Bill Bryson, Sarah Vowell, so many people. I think they all have in common that they use humor, even if it's a serious or tragic topic. There's always some humor in the book. They all put themselves into the story in a way that's not memoir and it's not self-serving, but they allow you to experience the journey through them.
Yeah, I've read many of those. Jan?
Well, my favorite adventure travel author is David Yeadon, and I read when I can read. When I'm not reading how-to books and those types of things, excuse me, I will read any adventure story I can get my hands on. I just recently, the last one I read was about an 18-year-old. I don't have her name at the top of my head, but she took on a 26-foot sloop, she took a trip around the world by herself, and
I remember
she was 18.
That. Yep.
So those are the kind of adventure stories that I love reading about. The other stories I'll read about are mostly to help myself perfect my writing, because they have something to say. And so, yeah, I read a lot of travel writers, yeah.
So I wonder what you think, what both of you think about what type of person is attracted to traveling. What are some of the characteristics that you think binds all of you in the same fashion? Do you have any thoughts?
You know, I've wondered about that, Sima, because I've had the travel bug ever since I was probably about 10 years old, and my mother put me on a bus in Hartford, Connecticut to visit my grandparents in Hyannis, Massachusetts. And from that point on, it was just the most exciting thing to be transported from one destination to another. And each trip I took, which were all my summer vacations growing up, it was just the most exciting thing in the world to me. And so I don't know what gave me that travel bug. My sisters don't seem to have it. One of them does. The others don't. So I say it's innate.
Well, it's an interesting concept because we all know people for whom the world ends at the end of their town or the end of their state or whatever, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also know people for whom they can't go far enough away. They can't, you know, I know several people who are trying to visit every continent before they die. And I just wonder what the innate passion is, what the need is that they're hoping to fill. Do you know what I mean?
I do know what you mean. I wish I had an answer. I would love one for myself.
John, what are your thoughts?
I think, I suppose ultimately it's curiosity of just what is over there. But I think, you know, for me, it's a lot of people have really romantic reasons for traveling, and mine is possibly less so, but I just have always felt more at home when I'm traveling than when I'm literally at home. I just feel more comfortable when I'm on the road.
That's interesting.
Better and work better. So obviously there will always be that if I'm stuck in one place, I always have that drive to get myself back out somewhere else just so I can feel like myself again. And it doesn't necessarily have to be anywhere far away or exotic, although I love that kind of travel as well. But, you know, it's just get me like on a train an hour away and I feel better, you know?
You know, I think it's an awareness of our surroundings. As we go through our daily life, it's pretty predictable most days. And we end up doing everything by rote, and we don't really see half the things that are in front of us because they're so familiar. And like you said, John, a curiosity is a huge part of it. I've always been a curious person. But again, it's the fact that when we go to a new place, we open our eyes. Mm-hmm. We see things. We feel things. And it just gives us a vitality that we don't get otherwise.
You know, if I might share my own personal philosophy, I've done an enormous amount of national and international travel. And especially with the my two youngest children who are now in middle school, I desperately, and I mean that, I desperately want them to understand, number one, that the United States is not the center of the world, and number two, that there really is a whole world out there. And that can be, you know, that can be international, national, or even local, but that there's a world out there that is only at the end of that bus trip, only at the end of that airplane trip, only at the end of that car ride. It's not so difficult to travel if you make the world be yours. Do you understand what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And
definitely.
I feel very strongly about giving them that that sense of comfort so that they can then make the choices. Where do they want to live? What lifestyle works best for them? You know, it's all about education as well.
And it's, and it's harder to understand yourself or your hometown if you've never stepped outside of it and seen other towns and other people and how other people live. It's not that you should travel for the conceited purpose of looking back at yourself, but it really helps you broaden your mind. So it's really education too.
Yeah, that's a very good point. In terms of packing, we haven't even talked about traveling by other means other than car. But before I ask you about packing tips, which I really would like, what is your favorite method of travel? Obviously, if we're talking about Connecticut, it's most likely car. But in terms of your travel experience in your lifetime, is there a method of travel that you prefer, a method of transportation?
You know, I probably prefer car just because I'm American, but obviously in some places that's not going to work. So I'll do the planes and trains and boats are more kind of the necessary evil to get to where you're going. I don't necessarily relish flying or anything like that, but I just do it.
Jen?
Yeah, definitely. I agree that all the other methods except automobile will allow me to get from one place to another. But then it's like get in my car, and that's the only way to explore other than my favorite way is once I get into a new town or a new city, then I get out of my car and walk. To me, walking is the only real way to see anything in your path and to be able to absorb it. But I prefer car travel, and of course, obviously, because I just did a huge car trip and 6,400 miles, and so yeah, that's my favorite method.
So when you get to your destination, do you pretend that you were raised there, lived there? Do you ever go through a kind of scenario in your mind that maybe you lived there a few hundred years ago? Either of you?
I don't consciously do that. No, I'm probably too wrapped up in just looking at everything that's around me.
I've never had that complex.
So I'm the only one of the three that constantly.
Yeah.
Well, I do that. And I actually do that for every place that I've ever traveled. I put myself in the shoes of the people who live there, and I really try to envision what would my life be like if I lived here now? What would my life be like if I lived here either when it was first settled or during some monumentous historical happenings? I did that when I was in the Colosseum in Italy, for example. I'm just saying that's my method. Anyway, what packing tips would you care to share today? Do you have tips you want to give the general public?
I have two, I think. One is don't check luggage. That obviously doesn't apply if you're driving your own car, but if you're flying or anything else, one carry-on, just keep it to that. It will save you so many different kinds of hassles. The other is, as far as clothing goes, before you leave, literally write down everything, every activity that you have planned or everything that you might do, and then write down the weather, and then figure out what you would realistically want to wear doing those activities in that weather, and don't pack for some fancy vacation. Pack for what you are really going to do, because I think I used to do this too. I think people think so much about what if, and then they end up with this huge suitcase full of clothing for what if we go out to this really fancy dinner one night, or what if we happen to find ourselves on a boat. Well, if you're not planning for those things, you probably won't do them. So that's just wasting space.
Jan?
Yeah, those are good tips. I guess my biggest tip is pack light, and my second biggest and third biggest, pack light, pack light, mm-hmm. pack light. Yeah, that's really the most important tip I could give anyone.
Well, I am of the era where when we used to go on a plane, we used to get into our finery, and we most definitely would wear the best shoes we could. Mm-hmm. And over time, I realized that there is no finery, and there's no reason to be wearing that. And so I think that's partially generational. Would you agree?
Absolutely, I would agree. I've seen it evolve through the years. I'm with you. You know, we used to get all dressed up when we went on an airplane.
Exactly.
You know, a suit even, a dress and shoes and nylons and whatever. I'd probably go back further than you, so I can probably even go further, but I won't.
No, but I think that was part of the methodology in traveling, is that you assumed you would go to the fancy restaurant. You would assume that you would be in the place where you didn't want to have your, you know, your, quote, walking around clothes, right?
Yes, but today, there's probably very few restaurants you couldn't go into in a just plain skirt and simple blouse. In other words,
correct.
There's very few places that we travel to that we have to get dressed up anymore.
Correct.
Or that we would want to, because you look around you, and everyone is just so casual, and that's the most comfortable feeling.
Sure. So I would like to talk a little bit about out of the state. Do either of you have strong feelings about particular states or countries, places that you've been that resonated or that you would like to encourage the listener to travel to?
Yeah, I would. Within the U.S., I would say cities that are not the major New York, L.A., Chicago, San Francisco, but the smaller cities that you might not immediately think of going to, St. Louis, Cincinnati, Philadelphia, Providence, I think a lot of people skip those, and those are amazing. And I think if you go, you'll find them fascinating. In terms of out of the country, I have a huge list, but I would like to get back to Israel because that's so far my favorite destination.
Mine too. Jan?
Well, I've traveled quite a bit out of the country as well, but I, because it's so fresh in my mind, I just, my new favorite places, when I went out west in 2009, I visited 10 national parks. All of them were new, and I just have such a feeling about our national parks that I didn't have before. I mean, I read about them, I marveled over them, but until you actually get into one of these national parks out west, you just have no clue how it's going to affect you. So I drove through 10 states. I not only visited the national parks, but the South Dakota, the Old West, and then I went west to visit the cities of Portland and Oregon and Washington, the states rather, and San Francisco, and back, you know, across the lower part of Utah and Colorado. And so I guess I would have to say that if there's anybody listening who has not taken a trip out west, you need to put that on your future travel list. It is just, some of you talked about you know, the beauty of the rest of the country and enlarging our view and our perspective. And that will do it. That will do it, going out west by road trip.
I agree completely. That was actually the first big trip I did by myself, was a road trip along the Lewis and Clark Trail, and I completely agree. Everyone should do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I have an interesting small story to tell, that we have been going on road trips with our kids, both internationally and nationally. And, you know, we would go to a place like Asheville, for example, or we've been to Tuscany, and we would get off, you know, situate ourselves, and then we would travel around and we would do amazing things. And I would find that at the end of the trips, I really didn't feel like my children were present. I don't know how to explain that, but it just felt like we did all these things and they kind of went through the motions. And so 2 years ago, we decided that we were going to take 10-day road trips. In both cases, we did 2,900 miles. 2 years ago, we went through every single state, going down to Nashville and then Atlanta, Georgia, and then came back up through the coast. Last year, we went straight across through like Baltimore, Philly, Pittsburgh, Ohio, Indianapolis, Detroit, and we hit every manner of possible interesting thing. You know, we went to Motown. We obviously went to Independence Hall. In either case, at the end of the 10 days, we had not only covered some unbelievable amounts of territory, but we had also uncovered these gems of the United States. And I found that in that kind of movement, the whole family was able to really take in the depth and breadth of what this country, for example, has to offer. Have you had any experiences like that?
I've had tons of experiences, but I guess my question is, are you saying it was because you were traveling in this country rather than another country that your kids were more present?
No, but I'm saying that in the original trips, we would land in a certain place and then do the 100-mile environs. In these particular instances, we did 2,900 miles each trip. And I just sort of felt like presenting them with the diversity of this country, presenting them with the hidden gems, not the tourist traps, but the places that I, too, did some investigating. You know, the Corning glassware and Niagara Falls on the Canadian side, for example. It just seemed to resonate with them more. And it just was an interesting exercise, because I hadn't expected that this was going to do better. We were going to do better this way either. I am just wondering if you've had similar experiences.
I think there's so many factors involved. It depends on the age of the kids. I've taken my kids, you know, on motor trips. I've taken them abroad. And all I can say is that I can relate to what you were saying earlier about them not being present at certain times, and at other times they were. And but even when they weren't present or seemingly present, they still absorbed a lot of the culture and a lot of the things that they were exposed to. I did find that out later, in later years, as I was talking to them when they were grown. So I think what you're doing with your kids, you're giving them such an important gift.
I hope so.
An important gift.
I hope so. Yeah. Jenna, do you have any final words? We're almost out of time.
Yeah, well, just about what you were just saying, I think there's a school of thought that travel is best when it comes closest to how we initially would have approached a place, which would have been very slowly on foot or horseback or on a ship, and there would be a long period of expectation, and you'd also be experiencing truly how far away you were going and the land that you were covering. And obviously a car is not completely optimal for that, but I think maybe just giving your kids that experience of covering the literal ground, as opposed to flying into a place and all of a sudden, you know, hours later and you're in this totally different place, I think that might give kids and adults some perspective of where they're going and where they've been.
Sure. We've been talking today with Jonna Kaplan and Jan Mann about traveling Connecticut. You can find Jonna Kaplan at thesizeofconnecticut.com and her website, johnnakaplan.com. Jan Mann's books include Cruising Connecticut with a Picnic Basket, How I Won the West, A Journey of Discovery. Jan's website is janmannbooks.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of For Women Over 40. This is WESU Middletown, 88.1 FM on your dial. And until next time, please take care.